Welcome to Tech Life Stories, sponsored by talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. My name is Khan Azmi and I'm your host. You will find me posting daily on LinkedIn, so connect with me there for more about the crazy world of technology. I have spent the past 25 years talking to tech leaders, so we will go behind the scenes each week, taking a deep dive into interviewing tech leaders to understand their journey from when they started to where they are today. I'll be finding out more about why they got into tech, discussing their work history, some of the projects they've been part of, some of the most influential people in their career, and much more. We produce a weekly show which is available every Monday at 6 a.m, just in time to start your week in the right way. And the podcast will be available on all platforms, including Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts. If you prefer to see us visually, you can also find us on YouTube channel, Tech Life Stories. So remember, it's not what people think of you when you first start, it's what people think of you when you finish. Hi, welcome to another episode of Tech Life Stories. I'm joined today by Lucy Grimwade. Quite a long bio, so bear with me. Lucy is a IT and improvement leadership consultant, running her own practice, private practice, should I say. She's a ICF accredited coach, a level 2 counsellor, author of a book on allyship, co-founder of Women of ITSM, co-host of Careers and Coffee, which is a podcast on YouTube, also a podcaster, host of Talk Female Friday, has worked in the world, worked for the likes of Virgin Media, Selfridges, Harrods, also has a bachelor's degree in computing. I think I finished my rundown on your bio, Lucy. Have I summed it up well?
Oh, do you know what? Thank you so much. What a lovely summary of all of the amazing and crazy things that I do. I really appreciate that.
That's okay. No problem. To be fair, I just went by your LinkedIn profile, so I got most of it from there.
Excellent.
Let's start with your private practice, because you've been working for yourself now for how many years?
So I have been side hustling probably for about 5 years. Okay. And then last year, last March 2023, I decided that I was going to leave my well-paying job at Virgin Media O2, at a company that I loved, and all the stuff I was doing, to go, do you know what, I'm going to try and do my own thing.
Good on you.
So for the last year or so, I have been doing my own thing, running it, freelancing, doing multiple different things. Yeah.
Good, good. Okay, so let's start with your background, because you come from a ITSM type background. Tell me how you kind of got into the industry. You know, what was your way in? Was it a chosen career path? And let's take some baby steps to where you got to today.
Yeah. Do you know what? What a great question. I actually chose to go into technology. However, what I will say is when I applied to go to university, which was a long time ago, I actually applied to go and do media studies because I quite liked marketing, I quite liked film, I quite liked all of that. That was kind of sexy and fun and cool. And I was doing A-level ICT, Information Communication Technology, just to go and show you how old I am, really. And I had an ICT teacher who said to me, she's like, you're really good at this. Have you thought about maybe doing your degree in something to do with tech or computing or IT and business? And I was like, oh, well, I've just applied to university now. I've just been accepted for media studies and to go and do that. And I thought about it. I thought, do you know what I am? I'm going to go and future-proof myself. I just kind of had this thought one day. And reapplied, had to go back through this whole reapplication and got a degree in computing. What I will say, oh my goodness me, is that doing your A-levels in ICT, which is like PowerPoint,
okay,
to going and doing a degree in computing is so different, like so crazy different. Do I regret it? No. Would I choose something else in future? Probably. I probably should have done like IT and business.
Okay.
I'm really going from there. I was one of the first in my kind of group cohort in my degree to go and get a job. I didn't go and get a grad job. I went and got a job on the service desk. And then that's where my IT service management career really began. Started on the service desk and really had a linear path and worked my way up to great things.
So did you get your first service desk job whilst you're at university, or did you wait until you did? Okay. And would you recommend that for individuals? You know, for some listeners now who's thinking about a career path into technology, you know, would you say it's a good option for someone who's at university?
Yeah, definitely. I really loved that I got a role. So I hadn't even finished my final year and I applied for a job. I went and worked in government out of all places. The pensions regulator was my first job out of university. And I went, applied for this role, got the interview. They knew I didn't have any kind of corporate experience. I'd never worked in an office before. Yeah. I'd only ever worked on the shop floor. So they knew what they were getting when they hired me. And I worked for them during the Easter holidays, which really helped me actually, because that was really, because I didn't do a placement yet either. So that really helped my initial kind of, I don't know, getting used to what corporate world was all about. And then when I finished my degree, it was so nice to know that I had a job to go to. Mm-hmm. Whereas some people went and done some traveling, which maybe upon reflection, could I have done that? Probably. But it was quite a nice opportunity to go and do something like that. And it wasn't a grad role, because a lot of people leave university and go and do a grad scheme.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think you touched on something there, which I think is really relevant to today's society, because I've got two teenagers. One's now worked for 2 weeks in a corporate, you know, work type experience, and I think he found it very, very different to what he was expecting. And I think, yeah, massively. And I think it's great that you went and got that experience, because it gave you that kind of, you know, whilst you're still studying, you know, that insight into what it's going to be like once your studies finish. Do you think? And I had this conversation on a previous podcast, but do you think maybe, you know, maybe at school or somewhere else along that line, that maybe we could do more to prepare people for the workplace, and how can we do that? You know, it'd be interesting to hear your insights into that.
Oh, I honestly think we need to change our whole education system full stop, because we don't set young people up for success when they leave school or university. Because they don't teach you like life skills, like how to apply for a mortgage, how to get a different bank account, how to get a credit card, how to manage your finances, and all like basic life adult stuff, right? I also think that years ago, and it's a long, long time ago, I did do a week's work experience. But where it depends where you're located. If you're like located near a city, you probably do have more, and you know, your parents might work somewhere that has an office. That's great. But what about the parents that don't have that kind of privilege or opportunity? And I think we need to really have a look at that. And schools need to interact with businesses a lot more, because at 16, I think is a great opportunity for, you know, people of that age to go and like spend a week in an office to really understand that it's not like what you see on TV. It's not like Suits or, you know, or even The Office. It's not like that at all.
Two great programs, by the way.
I like both of those. I think it can be either scary and sometimes kind of cool, because some offices are kind of cool now with like pool tables, and then they do certain different like activities and events and community groups and stuff, which is amazing. But I think we're not setting up young people ready for that. So when they get there, a bit like rabbit in headlights, like, oh, and they don't even know how to send an email or use Excel, which is so easy to pick up and use, but we use it every day. Of course, we're going to find it easy, right? Yeah. But we need to set our young folk up for that.
I completely agree with you. There was actually a organisation which was near me who actually run a government funded programme, which I think helped, there were pre-apprenticeship level individuals on a 6-week program preparing them to go into the workplace. And I think that government funded programs actually stops now for some reason, probably due to a lack of budgets. But I actually thought it was a really good program. Imagine spending 6 weeks in an office where someone's preparing you, like you said, to send emails, how to answer phone, how to handle your, how to talk to your employees, when to take a break, when not to take a break, what are the right things to say, what are the right things not to say in the office. And I feel it was such a good program that maybe we need something like that to kind of help that kind of bridge from school education going into the workplace. Because I remember when I was 19 years old, I got my first office job, funny enough, in recruitment, so it's been a long time now. but I still remember, like you said, I still remember having to send an email. I hadn't sent an email, like a proper professional email previously. And it was very new to me. And back then I had to send some faxes, which again shows my age, but I didn't really know how to use a fax machine. And I just lacked the kind of work experience that I think a lot of children or young adults need going into the workplace. So I think it's definitely something that as a country that we could work on a lot better to help prepare our young adults for work experience going forward, basically.
Yeah, and the behaviours too, right?
Very much so.
I don't know about you, even I just remember when I first started working, I remember I asked my manager if I could go to the loo.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Isn't that hilarious? And in fact, I did have somebody that was reporting into me once, an apprentice, that asked me like if it was okay for them to go for lunch. And I was like, yeah, like, why are you up? But for me, it's like normal.
Exactly.
Like, it's 12 o'clock, 12:30, I'm going for lunch. But that permission. But also there's language, isn't there? Mm-hmm. There's like things that you would say in the office, things that you wouldn't say in your office. Just, you know, there's just definitely with like Gen Z now coming into the workforce, which makes me feel so old. I actually had someone say to me the other day, oh, when I grow up, I'd like to be like you. And I was like, oh, I can't believe I've literally got to this point in my career now where people are saying that
to
me.
I would take that as a positive. You're inspirational. Someone wants to be like you. That's a good thing.
It made me feel old.
Oh, no, you're not at all. Going back again to something you mentioned, which I've written down as a note to bring up. You mentioned when you was at, I think you was at school, and a teacher said to you, you should be looking at IT rather than that's good. I like that. Like someone had seen something in you and kind of steered you away from something you thought you were going to do to actually something that you went and did and actually stayed in that career path all the way through. What was it about that teacher? Did you have a close relationship with them? Did they see something in you? How did that happen? Because I think that's quite important, actually. And it's quite, not unheard of, but I think it'd be nice if, or not nice, but maybe teachers should do that more. Maybe they should have a bit more of an influence on children making those decisions.
Yeah, 100%. I don't know if I had a close relationship. I think I'm naturally quite good at building relationships with people. Mm-hmm. I think I've always been like this. I'm quite curious. I ask a lot of questions. I try and be open. I try and be friendly. And this was sixth form at a tiny school that I went to. So there wasn't that many of us anyway. Okay. There was probably about four or five of us in this A-level ICT class. So, you know, I had that advantage. And I just think it just enjoyed it. And I asked a lot of questions and the work I produced was, I guess, was good. And she, which is also really nice, that it was another woman in tech, right, going to a potential woman in tech, which was me, to say, hey, do you know what? And she told me a story about how she went to university and did a kind of robotics degree, and how then someone was doing all the lighting for like celebrities, like singers and rap stars and all of that. And I think I quite liked that too.
Cool.
For me, yeah, it made it kind of, again, sound quite cool, etc. But it was just really interesting because I did A-levels in, that was my only kind of STEM subject. Yeah. My other two subjects I was doing was media studies and English Lit.
Okay.
And when I went and said, oh, I'm changing this now to do a degree in computing, everyone was like, but why? Yeah. You've been doing media studies. You like to read. You like to be creative. And I just thought, well, after having that teacher say something to me, I thought, well, I want to try and future-proof myself.
Yeah.
You know, technology isn't going away. There's always going to be jobs in tech. So why not try it out? It was hard. I'll be honest. I talk about it. But doing a degree in computing was really, really hard. It wasn't because of naturally I'm an open, more kind of process-driven, managerial person. Mm. The real nitty-gritty, like, programming and building a machine from scratch, although it was rewarding when I did it, it was really tough, really, really tough.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And I will come back to that, but I'm thinking about my 15-year-old son at the moment who's doing computing as a GCSE, and it's very focused on programming. And when I talk about technology, he just says, yeah, programming, you know, developing. I said, no, there's so much more to that. And I think that's where the breakdown happens at school or an education institute, of educating. Actually, there are very lots of different paths in technology. You don't have to be an out and out techie. You can actually really utilize your communication skills really, really well in technology. You can work on some great kind of like transformation change type projects, or, you know, in that IT service management type industry. But I think there's a little bit of a breakdown from that. So when you was in school and you was making that decision, and you said obviously, you know, it wasn't an easy kind of degree for you. What was it, purely just the tech side which was difficult for you? Was there other elements of your degree that was difficult? That'd be interesting to know.
Yeah, I think when I was doing my degree, the jobs that I do now didn't exist either. So I had no idea what I was going to go and do. I was also, there was like a couple of hundred students. I was, again, the only female. Okay. There was maybe one or two of us, actually. I shouldn't say I was the only one. There's probably one or two of us. But compare that ratio to, say, 200 or 300 men. You know, it that was hard too. It was just, you know, I didn't notice it so much until I kind of got through the degree more and more. And I was realizing that there weren't very many women, and they weren't asking the same questions. Mm. And the guys that were there, they wanted to go off and be a programmer or go and... I don't know, the computing degree that I did allowed you to pick different subjects, as in you got to choose all your subjects that you were doing, which was amazing. Lots of them wanted to go and like work for the police and do like a CSI kind of role. And I just knew I wanted to like do something in technology, but I didn't know what. And I definitely knew when I was doing some of this technical stuff that I knew I didn't want to do it. I say I couldn't do it. It's more that it didn't interest me or excite me. I liked the people element stuff. I picked some of the subjects were like business development and like process and ethics. And I loved all of that, which, again, I had no idea I was going to end up working on a service desk. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, and look, you come across so well. I can see your people skills shine through and through, 100%, without a doubt. So I get that. So when you first did that kind of IT service desk role, obviously, there would have been a technical element to it, but you use your communication skills really well. How did you then, once you went into that role, did that give you an inkling of this is the right career path? Or was the questions that you might have been raising your head about it not being the right career path? And how did that lead you on to your next role? And then how did you end up to where you are today and that transition going through?
Again, and you know, it's something that you said about the skills that you get taught, you know, at maybe school level or even university level. Nobody taught me how to use like a ticketing system. Mm. So I got taught that on the job. Nobody taught, like, IT support isn't necessarily that technical in the sense that, you know, standard, have you turned it off?
Turn again? Yeah.
Honestly, every time it works. Why? Don't know. Anyway. Doing the courses and stuff, people don't set you up for that. So when I was going and doing when I first worked on the service desk, I've always worked in retail, right? So I know customer service, and being on the service desk, that's customer service. That's answering the phone to somebody and sorting their problem out for them. And even if I couldn't solve it, sometimes I had to go and get like a second line engineer to fix it, especially the early days, because I had no idea, like, you know, that's broke, what? I'd get a second line engineer, but it's the way you manage that person. It's the way you kind of go, oh, do you know what? I actually don't know, but let me go and find someone that can help you.
Yeah.
And I think it's about managing that stakeholder, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and I think that stakeholder understands, right? If you can't solve that problem, that there is going to be someone else there that can help. And as long as you communicate that with them, then I think they're fine. After that first IT service desk job, then, did you then go into another service desk type role? Or talk to me about what that kind of like process was.
Yeah, so I did a couple of service desk roles. So I was about a year in my kind of first one, and I was living in my parents.
Okay.
And I was literally like getting the bus to work, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to move to London. I was like, I can't stay living with my parents. All my friends were living in London, so I went and moved to London.
Where was you living at the time, though?
Where was I living at the time? Near Brighton. Okay, so it was still kind of cool, like, it's still a really cool place, but hey, I grew up around there. That's not cool anymore for me. I wanted to be in London with everyone. It might be really fun. So I ended up getting a job on a help desk, a service desk with a bank. And it was the best experience that I could really ever ask for. I learned so much about myself, about service management, about what not to do, how not to behave. People that work on the trading floor are not nice people. I have to really get like some resilience really quickly. Like, I have some horror stories for you, like honestly. But it really allowed me to figure out there was more than just answering a phone, and it taught me like ITIL. I ended up being put on ITIL courses, and I had no idea that there was this whole thing around it with service management. There was this whole thing like design, and there was transition and improvement, and oh my goodness, and I loved it. I was very fortunate because I would work the service desk. I ended up being a bit of a TL and had a team myself, so that was pretty cool. I was quite a young manager. But then I ended up working with the service delivery managers, who perhaps are like typical service delivery managers, you know, white male of a certain age, you know, not going anywhere, been at the bank for a long time, just waiting for their payout, like honestly. And they would say it to me, so I'm not even saying anything, you know, but they wouldn't even say to me, right? And it was a long time ago, right? And I said that to them. I said, "Oh, I'm really interested in maybe like progressing. I don't want to go and do like a technical role because I could have gone and done like app development, or you know, maybe looked after the desktop support guys or the third level guys." And it was Citrix, that was a thing at the time, you know. Yeah, like that was the thing. I didn't want to do telephony either. I didn't want to do infrastructure. I got it. I could see it and understand it, but did I want to go and like support it and fix it and get, I didn't,
Didn't excite you.
no one can see me now. Yeah, like made me cringe a little bit. So I ended up working with these two service, both called John actually, these two service delivery managers who just kind of took me under their wing, taught me how to do like things like a service catalogue, which I thought was so cool. Look, now I'm like, oh God, a service catalogue. But at the time I thought it was so cool. And it made me realise that I wanted to navigate and shift into that space. Unfortunately, because they'd been there for such a long time, they weren't going anywhere soon, and there wasn't really an opportunity for me to kind of go into that area with them, other than I was doing really silly hours, which I would never recommend this to anyone, but I really wanted to prove myself. So I was doing the half 6 a.m. shift on the service desk to half 2. I would then go and have a break, and then I would come back at like 3, 4 o'clock, and then spend until 7, 8 p.m. trying to like learn from them. So I'd work crazy hour days just to try and get ahead in my career. I look back on that now thinking that was probably, it probably has set me up for some success, but I also think it burnt me out too much.
Think that was the kind of given back then a little bit. I think I was the same in, when I first got into recruitment. I think it was more people looked at the time you put in more and proving yourself, whereas I think it's less looked upon now. So I do get the bit where you've been, and it's a long day effectively, 6:30 a.m. and sometimes you're not finishing until 7, 8 p.m. Now doing your job and then learning. So I do get it, but like you said, it probably gave you the insight into moving into that kind of more service delivery type aspect of a role. Just one thing I wanted to touch on before we move on to that is you mentioned you was on trade floor and building up resilience. I know when I've recruited in the past for trade floor type environments, prerequisite that they always want is someone that's worked or used to working on a trade floor, so they can hit the ground running. They know the type of individuals. They are difficult. They can be really, really difficult. So it was interesting to hear that you went from the pensions regulator to that type of environment. I would have gone one extreme to the other. So it must have been like a completely different world for you at the time, right?
I had no idea. I had no idea what it was going to be like. I just thought it looked cool. It was a bank. You know, again, back in the day, you know, working at a bank, that's a really good job to have. Go and get a job at the bank, you know. And I think that's what it was all about. It's such a whirlwind. And I have to say that when I say it gave me lots of learnings and lots of, you know, opportunities, I also think it gave me a lot of, it knocked some of my confidence and stuff too, with some of the sexism that I experienced too, because again, I was only female in the department. The trade floor is typically male as well. Stuff that was said to me was really interesting. stuff that was said to us as a department was very interesting as well. And back then, it's so different now, because back then I just kind of was like, oh, okay, like, and like laughed. Whereas now, if someone said anything to me, I'd be like, right, come here, let me tell you something right now.
Yeah. But do you think that also comes with experience, right?
Yeah.
I think I don't know, maybe some grads that are coming through the ranks now would say something, but I think most would probably turn a blind eye a little bit. I'm not sure whether I should say anything or not. Whereas over time, you kind of, you know, with experience, you kind of know when to question and when not to question things, right?
Yeah, I also think the generations that are coming up through the workplace now, they've got access to way more than what I would have had access to back then. You know, stuff that's now shared on, you know, Instagram and TikTok wasn't even a thing. Mm-hmm. Like back then, she says. So I never knew any of this stuff that was happening or understood it. I just thought, I don't know, I didn't really think of it. Whereas generations that are coming into the workplace now, they're way more switched on with it. Yeah. So I think that they probably would say something to say, hey, do you know what? That's making me feel uncomfortable. Mm. Please don't do that. Yeah. Whereas I didn't have that experience or exposure to being able to say, has a line manager that's probably the same age as me now, just he didn't really know what to do or say either. He was like, oh, you'll be fine. I'd be like, I'm not fine.
Quite interesting, but, and we're kind of off topic with this a little bit, with this sexism a little bit, but do you still experience any of that in today's world?
I wish I could say to you no, but the truth is I do.
Okay.
And hence why, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit later, hence why David Barrow and I are writing a book about allyship for women in the workplace fundamentally, is because we're still experiencing sexism. And I went to an event last year and somebody asked me if I had got lost and should I have been going shopping. Charming. And it's just, I know, and just things like that, or they don't look at me, they look at other parts of my body, and they won't. And that happened to me last year when I went to like a trade event. And it irritates me, because I think we have come so far, yet we're still so stuck. Yep. And it's disappointing, to be honest. And I really wish I could say, no, it's changed. Mm-hmm. You know, the world is more like equitable, but it's not.
Okay. I think We will cover that a little bit more then later on when we talk about the book with David Barrow. Let's just go back to what we're talking about. So you were learning about service delivery management, you know, in the evenings in your job. So what was your next step? How did you get into that a little bit more and take you off the service desk then?
So I ended up applying for a job at another kind of financial services firm. And I was a service delivery kind of assistant, is how I can probably word it. And then that's where my true service management career kind of took off, because I went and did a role there. It was only on a fixed term. I think it was like a 6 months fixed term I did, but I wanted to take it, even though it was going to, I had to move for it as well. But I was so desperate to go and get that title and go and get that experience. I couldn't go from being a service desk kind of manager to a service delivery. It just wasn't. So I had to take that kind of, for me at the time, had to take that kind of sidestep, maybe, if I can call it that.
Yeah, no, I get it. Just, I mean, because I think a lot of the listeners will be, some of them might be in the same shoes, wanting to take a step like that. How many years after you first got into service desk and then you went for that job? How many years was that?
I would say that was probably about 2 or 3 years.
All right, that's quite quick, actually.
Well, yeah, I move quite quick.
You're ambitious. I like it. There's nothing wrong with
ambitious.
That.
I'm ambitious.
Definitely. Okay. Okay, so after 2 or 3 years, you've applied for the job, you've got the job, you're now in the role of service delivery assistant, was it?
Something along the lines of a service delivery assistant. And it was cool. Like, I did it. I said it was cool. It gave me what I needed. Mm. So I got to get involved in service reviews, and I had to work with suppliers, and I then worked with kind of building out like a service catalogue and what that looks like. And because I had already done some of that at the bank, I knew I could crack on and do it at this financial service place that I was at. And that was really great. And then when that 6 months kind of came to an end, I then ended up in a role where I was back really doing a really mixed role. Like, it was service support manager, because I had some desktop support engineers reporting into me. But I also like looked after the telephony service. This was for an insurance firm. What else did I do? I did a lot of like really random service stuff. However, what an experience that was, because I didn't just do one thing. I did multiple things. I got involved in like information security as well, and all that desktop. Oh, I even had to like, because I had a team, right? And I wanted to lead by example. When we did desk moves, and I would never ask them to go and do a weekend shift, and I'd be rolling up my sleeves, moving machines out of the way. And back then, everyone's got a laptop, right? Back then, it was like these old big old fat clients down there, and they're, oh my goodness me,
probably getting under the desk and unplugging cables and all that type of stuff. Old school desk
people
moves,
are disgusting.
They are.
The stuff that under people's desks. Oh, it's gross. Gross, gross, gross.
I'm still old school. I don't have a laptop. Well, I do, but because I've got a set desk in my office, I like a PC, and I've got two screens. So you might see me looking over here sometimes because I've got my second screen, basically. So I'm still old school.
Oh, do you know what? I'm here for that. But at the same time, I love my Mac.
Don't blame you. Don't blame you at all. Okay, so you kind of went into this insurance role a little bit different, a bit varied. Where's the moment where things kind of like took off for you, where you really kind of like got into the kind of full IT service delivery management, IT process improvement? Where did Lucy Grimway make herself or become
so
herself?
I ended up. I love it. I would say that I ended up meeting my partner. And I ended up moving in with him. So there's some context around this. And he lived like 50 miles away from where I was working and living. And I ended up getting a job. I tell the story to everyone. I ended up getting a job near where he lived.
Okay.
And I was like, do you know what? It'd be easier if I just moved in with you. Because then then I can go and do this job. So this job was at TK Maxx, yep. TJX, TJX Europe. And that, for me, I loved working there so much. Loved, loved, loved it. Just honestly, it was great. But for me, that gave me that's where it all started for me. So I worked doing service transition, as a service transition manager. I'd gone from doing kind of European projects to suddenly doing global projects to suddenly going and learning how to map out an entire end-to-end service design and transition process, just from all like the different skills that I've picked up along the way, and then going and studying and learning and kind of putting them into place. I ended up building this whole service design and transition global process, and I ended up teaching it globally to the teams, and ended up having some of those global people having a dotted line into me. And it just happened again. All my stories, it's so quick, it just happens so quickly. I would have stayed there, and then I had a bit of a shift and change, a bit like all kind of retailers, if I'm honest with you. They every kind of couple of years they like to kind of, you know, outsource, if in so many words, really. And they ended up outsourcing a lot of that team, which then allowed me to go move into Harrods. So I did a fixed term contract there. But I literally like doubled my salary by moving, doing that.
Okay.
And I just think it was one of the, again, financially the best move for me. But like I got, again, so much experience and skill set with that. So I'd gone and done that globally. Then I was doing it at Harrods. Had a good leader who had some really good ideas. He was an ITIL expert, IT service management expert. He taught us a lot. I ended up getting involved in some like NDA projects, which was great. And then that contract ended. They changed that department around a little bit. And then I went and worked at Selfridges. And then that was a whole new... I originally went to Selfridges to do a contract, like an actual outside of IR35. In fact, IR35 wasn't really a thing then. But like, I went to go and do a contract, how old contracts were, right? And then the head of was like, don't suppose you want to come and be a service delivery manager for me instead? Because I went to go and do service transition. And then you like pitch this whole kind of, can I come and be his SDM for supply chain and buying a merch? And I was like, oh, do you know what? He's like, well, how much do you want? And I gave him a number. And then he said yes. And I was like, great.
Should have asked for more then. Yeah.
Oh, no. So I ended up, some of this sounds like I'm very lucky, but I think I've just been, I have maybe luck, but maybe I've made my own luck.
Right place, right time, I believe.
Right, yeah, right place, right time. Oh, do you know what? I say this to everybody. I miss my Selfridges discount every
Oh,
day.
I bet you do. My wife would as well, 100%, if she had it before. And she's worked in retail, funny enough. So we've benefited from some discounts. One thing that you and we'll touch on all of the clients you've mentioned, TJX, Harrods, and Selfridges. But at TJX, it sounds like it was such a great role, service transition, global projects. Mapping out the whole service design and transition process, and then teaching that globally. Just for some of our listeners that don't understand, maybe. When you say service design, what does that mean exactly? We interrupt this podcast to mention our sponsors, tech talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. If you're looking for work or looking for your next hire, please head to their website and register your interest at russellkingassociates.com. Right, back to the show.
So we'd basically you would take a someone's like drawn up some new technology, an architectural diagram, and it's a new service, for example, and it's going to come in. I'm trying to think of a service now, like a filler on the spot thinking of a service, like a new order fulfillment service. So you're going to pull out how customers would buy a, I don't know, a bag from a website, and there would be an old system of how that would go through, and then you'd want to replace that system. So I would have a look and I would design what that would look like. So what are the integrations? Who's going to need to support it? What are the SLAs? Who are the suppliers? And I'd have a whole look and a picture about that. And then I would transition it into that support team. So typically, before kind of service design transition was a thing, and some companies still don't really implement it properly, if I'm honest. They would just chuck it over the fence and go, oh, a project would go, oh, we're going to rip out this old kind of order fulfillment system. We're going to put this new system in, which could be a dramatic change. You might need new staff, you might need new skill set, you have a new supplier. Has legal even looked at that contract? What's our clauses? What's our get out? How are we going to get those service credits? Have you thought about any of that? That's the kind of thing I would do as a design transition lead manager. And then I would help kind of get that over and involve those support teams. Whereas some places just go, oh, here you go, here's a new thing now for you, enjoy. And then you've got like poor people, poor kind of support people and service delivery managers going, oh, how am I going to support this? But it's about doing that nice kind of handshake handover to say, here's the SLAs, here are the way we're going to support it, here is some new budget that we've need to secure, so you need to hire some new teams. Sometimes when you do things like this too, you have to do a bit of a reorg with it. So that technology that that person was supporting, well, we've thrown that out now. So you can either reskill someone or you then end up making that person redundant. And it can be as just black and white as that. Does that give you a bit of
Yeah,
a
it does.
snapshot of design
No, yeah,
transition?
100%. And then you mentioned that not all companies do that. I would have thought most larger corporates would have that in place. Or you tell me, you've worked for quite a few, do some of the larger still not have that then?
Well, I'm not going to name
No
names,
names,
but
but yeah.
no names, but not everybody does, or they would have that capability, but then new kind of idea, how like agile is now like a big thing, I think then everyone goes, oh, we're agile now, but just because you're agile and you do agile projects, that doesn't mean that you can't skip some of the really important stuff like building out a process because you're going to agile deliver this project, good for you, but how are you going to support? Who's going to support it? Well, who's going to be there when it goes down and it breaks? And then customers, sticking with my order fulfillment kind of example here, what are you going to, who's going to support it when suddenly the whole system cuts down and then the business is losing billions of pounds per hour because the system's gone down and nobody knows how to support it? So I think, yeah.
No, it's good. It's really good. Like, if you think about a typical customer, my wife as a customer, for example, she would have no idea about the time element and the process element that goes into the thought process. And like I said, there's the whole service element of that. As a customer, she just wants to click a button, hit buy, and everything's done. But everything behind the scenes is so much more detailed, and it's great the way you kind of like broke that down, because I completely get it. So when you went on to places like Howards and Selfridges, was it similar, or was it different in the process and the service kind of design and transition process, would you say?
Yeah, I'd say that they are similar, but I'm a massive believer in there's kind of, ideal best practice, but then there's also right practice for the business. Mm. So just because something worked really well in like TJX or something worked really well in Harrods doesn't mean it was going to work really well in Selfridges. So it was about trying to find, what's needed. And a long time ago, I would say, like, old school, more kind of SD&T service line transition managers would be very like big on tick lists and creating reams and reams of documentation. We're not wired like that now. Just think with what how our concentration is what like
minimal
less than 30 seconds, isn't it? Or like, isn't it like, oh, I don't know, three seconds? I don't know what it is. Maybe someone can message us and tell us what it is. But I when I've gone in and I've seen that, especially when I worked in some of the places I've worked now with contracts as well, I'm like, you don't need that. You need like a one pager would do, or a knowledge article in your ticketing system, your tooling. I don't think I'm quite answering your question, but I think it's not the same, but it is the same. But it's about finding the right thing for the business.
And then you mentioned there like a one pager, for example. As an example, but that then is rolled out to everyone, like in service delivery or service, in the ITSM area. Is that quite easy to, for a newbie coming in, easy to absorb, or does that actually need to be taught in a little bit more detail to them?
I think it depends on what it is. I've ran training sessions, or I've got the technical teams that built the thing to go and run some training sessions, or the supplier that wants that team to do a certain thing. I'm like, okay, so you want us to do something before it comes to you. You need to come and run some training sessions. I've always tried to make sure that's baked into a contract. Some stuff, the kind of step-by-step guides should be easy for you to do. But I also, from how I work and what I like to do, I'm not saying that everybody does this, but I really do love to do like either run a training session, get a training session run by an SME. I also like them to sign it off to tell me that they know what they're doing.
Okay.
So, because I don't want to be, a few months later, someone being like, you didn't transition this properly because the team don't know what I'm doing. But I also don't want that team to be stuck and worried for themselves and that they can't do it. So, yeah.
Okay. So you had your stint in retail, TJX, Harrods, Selfridges, leads you into Virgin Media O2.
Yeah.
And this is before you then take it and set up your own practice. But let's just touch on Virgin Media O2. Talk me through, what you did there. You don't tell me about the projects, but, the realm of what you kind of like looked after.
Yeah. So I got approached by somebody to come in and do a fixed term contract on looking after and building out business-to-business, end-to-end processes. So it was about coming in, having a look at all of those service management IT processes that are for business-to-business, so from incident and problem and change, and finding kind of waste and fault and fixing that. So I couldn't do that on my own, and I ended up... I don't know how this happened. I think I just kind of put a call out and then loads of people jumped on it. But I ended up with a team of like a project program team of 20 who, as they got to know me, they were excited about the work. They wanted something extra for themselves to do. I'd really encourage them to come up with ideas and we'd go and like loop around the business, because I joined as it was just O2, and then the joint venture happened, and then I ended up just looking at O2 business to business end to end processes, to looking at VMO2, that whole landscape, which was cool, was actually really cool. I got to like draw out a whole like operating model of what that looks like, and that went up to like senior level, which was great. I would say VMO2 gave me some amazing career highlights. from all of the stuff I did with continual service improvement, I got to learn more about what that means for IT service management and how important it is. Because again, coming from service design and transition, you know, you put in a process and then you think, oh, you know, that's the process now, you've got to do it. But actually, you know, as business goes on and people change and things change, you need to continually to look at those processes. Are they working out for us? Is our customer happy? You know, that was the main thing, right? I was in business to business. Our heart of the thing was about our customer, which I thought was really, really fun and interesting to do. But I also got involved in the Women's Network, and I ended up being, even though I was about only meant to be there for a fifth term, it got extended. I ended up being one of the senior leaders in the Women's Network for the personal development space. Mm-hmm. And like becoming a coach and all of that, which is a whole other thing that I did on the side of doing this tech career that I've done, this service management career I've done. I got to do that, which meant I got to go and like challenge the C-suite, which I love doing, and question them and think about what we're doing for the women in the business. And yeah, I've waffled on you there about that. Yeah, haven't
I? Good. Really good. A couple of things I've noted. You mentioned that you ended up with a team of 20. Is that right? Yeah. So,
How did that
come about? Like, and you know, and were these people you knew? Were these new people? How do you interview people? What do you look for in people when you interview them? It'd be really interesting for our listeners to know that.
Yeah, on this occasion, I didn't interview anyone because it was a project team, and it was within my gift to build out this team of people, but they would give me probably like an hour to 3 hours a week, so it wasn't like a full-time role for them. It was like extra work for them, something for them to do, something to build their own personal development with, etc., but also to make a difference and impact. So I started off with just a couple of people that were given to me almost, and then kind of word got about of what I was doing, what we were trying to change, and I had people message me to say, hey, Lucy, I've heard that you've been doing this. Please, may I come along? I have these ideas. And it just so happened that I needed those types of people. And there were different people from different teams, from different, like the different service desk to app support, to service delivery. And they all came in and we built out this kind of continual service improvement group. And we would kind of come together and come up with ideas and do a lot of discovery work and some data. And I had somebody who was excellent at data, and he would go off and like find all this data and stuff for me and then bring it back and present it. And I even had one chap in the team as well who's never presented to anyone before ever, or like, and I was like, as soon as you tell me that, I was like, right, this is your activity, this is what you're going to do, you're going to come back and present to us. And yeah, that's how I kind of accidentally created a beast of a team.
So everyone that came to you was an internal member of staff already.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So let's say, for example, that was someone on a service desk. You would just utilize their skill sets for a certain amount of time. Is that what you're saying? As well as then continue still doing their service desk type role?
Yeah, but that was so great because I had someone with that SME knowledge they were dealing with customers day to day. Honestly, it was so great. Even the line manager I had at the time was like, how have you done this? I was like, I literally just don't know. Like, I just put people wanted to come and work with me and do this, and that's great. Yeah. You know, cool.
No, I like it. I like it a lot. I think it'd be good for more organisations to embrace that kind of working, because I think a lot of organisations are siloed. That's your role. But, you know, I represent one organisation that we recruit for in my recruitment business who do something similar, actually. They allow individuals to go and work in different teams, different departments, because they realise that people want more sometimes. They want a challenge. They want to change. And rather than losing that talent to another employer, why don't you just move them internally? Give them something different and look after them. I love representing that organisation, and that works really well. And I think more organisations should be like that. We'll move on, because you mentioned again about the Women in Network piece. And obviously, I know you're trying to do a lot. Well, you've always done a lot with women in tech, but that personal development piece that you were talking about, how much did you have to give to that? You know, was it once a week kind of like check in, or was it more than that?
It really depended on my own workload. Again, I was very fortunate because it was in my gift to like manage my own time and manage my workload. And some days I could give them a day a week. Sometimes it was an hour a week. Sometimes it was 0 hours a week. But the two kind of co-chairs, when I said I had ideas, they just let me run with it. Okay. So again, I was in a very fortunate position, and I was lucky because I, in the background from doing all of this, I've done the coaching and the counselling, and I've done a lot of personal development work myself. And I love sharing kind of my own journey and helping other people kind of go on their own journeys too. I was able to kind of share all of that and run sessions. So when the joint venture was happening and people were unsure about their jobs, I ran sessions on like CVs and interviews and cover letters and personal branding. And then at one point we ran, it was Fashion Week, and I was like, shall we do like a Women's Network Fashion Week? And we did, and we had kind of external speakers come to us. And it wasn't just about like, oh, this is the latest trend, this is what you should wear, but it was people coming and talking about like confidence and body dysmorphia and what it's like having ADHD and but also liking fashion. And it was just, I would say, this is why I always say that VMO2 gave me so many career highlights, is because it gave me so many things that I could go and do and the passion stuff that I had.
That's good. It's great to hear. So at what moment did you realise that that kind of corporate world, you know, on a permanent type basis was done for you and you wanted to set up your own thing? And you said, I think you mentioned it, you started as a side hustle and kind of last year kind of went solo. Tell me a bit more about that.
I think it's not, just like disclaimer, it's not a nice reason really why. I had, when I started coaching, I actually wasn't very well. So this was probably about 5-6 years ago. I just had some mental health challenges, and then I went and did CBT, and then I soon realized that I loved going on my own healing journey, but I equally liked helping other people. And then that kind of gave me that light bulb moment of how am I gonna try and help other people, because I love doing my IT, like I love doing it with the stuff that I do, but I equally love helping people, like what do I want to go and do with my life. And I seem to have like mapped something out for myself now, but it's taken me a long time to get to this point. And then kind of towards the end of kind of 2022 into 2023, I sadly kind of lost some people in my life, and there were some other challenges that had gone on with my role at VMO2 as well because of the joint venture. That meant my role was significantly different to what I was doing originally. I wasn't getting that same buzz from it anymore. And there was some other kind of moving personal parts, if I'm honest, you know, that made me go, life's really short. Do I want to, you know, get to the end of my life and regret anything? Not really. So just because of those moments that happened, I was like, I'm just going to do it. And I had an amazing mentor, David Barrow, always shouting him out. You know, spoke to him. There were some other people in my life as well who I floated the idea dear by. And I just kind of, if I'm honest, I just kind of went for it. I hand my notice in, they're like, oh, you know, congratulations, what job? I was like, I haven't got a job to go for. I'm just going to go and try and figure this out. And it's been so hard. It's been crazy, but it's also been super rewarding as well.
Okay. All right. So first of all, sorry to hear about some of the mental health issues you've had to experience. Obviously, no one wants to hear that. And obviously losing a couple of people. So sorry to hear that. But obviously, I want to touch on where you're at today, because obviously you mentioned it's been hard. So running your own private practice, what does that look like? What does that look like in regards to, are you a day rate contractor when you run your own practice, and how do you go about winning your work at the moment? How does that work?
So I do a couple of things. I'm definitely saying I'm still finding my feet with it. It's not something that's, you know, I don't have a lot of, I'm building them up now, but I wish I built some more contacts up beforehand. Mm-hmm. So yeah, day rate contracts, which are inside or outside I-35, it really, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to pay mortgage. Yep. I can't just, you know, I've done some ad hoc projects too, which have been like a week's worth of work or kind of 6 weeks worth of work. And it's kind of come in here's the kind of scope of work, crack on, do that, deliver, done. And then that's been either day rated or project cost. I've also done a lot more coaching as well, which has been really like what I love doing the most. I don't know, maybe both of them are the same, but maybe coaching kind of goes up a little bit with it. So I've ended up getting more coaching clients as well, which has been brilliant. And then that's just a bog standard fee. But additionally, doing all of this stuff has allowed me more time and flexibility to kind of co-author this book with David, which I'm so excited about, do things like this with you, like do podcasts, right? And I think, yeah, that's it. But you know what, I feel like I've made it out to be like really like sugar-coated. I've had moments last year where I was like, what have I done? Like, I literally have no money right now. Like, I really don't want to go into my savings. You know, have I even got enough savings to do this? I turned down work, which was stupid because I felt like it wasn't the right thing for me. And really, I, upon reflection, I think, oh, I really should have just done that job. You know, so I definitely have learned a lot. And yeah, when I look back and I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have done this and should have, but I'm here where I am now, right? So
yeah, 100%. Listen, we all live and learn still, right? There's no one knows everything. So you're going to make mistakes, and you just got to learn from those mistakes at the end of the day. But I worked for two previous recruitment companies, and everyone kept saying to me, are you ever going to set up on your own? And I had a really good, you know, six-figure, well-paid job at my previous organization. And I kept saying to myself, am I going to live to regret never setting up my own recruitment organization? And it's been 10 years now, so obviously it's worked, which is great, but I think I would have regretted it if I had never taken that leap. So sometimes you just got to take that leap. The first few years were very, very hard. Like you say, you don't want to dig into your savings, you're trying to get by, and you live and learn. But as the years go on and you start to run your business, you kind of know what works and what doesn't work, and the type of work you should be taking and you shouldn't be taking. So I completely get where you're at with that. And obviously you've got some of the, you mentioned some potential coaching work as well. Just touch on that a little bit for me, because obviously you are a ICF accredited coach, you're a level 2 counsellor. What type of coaching exactly do you do?
I tend to do a lot more IT leadership coaching, and I do some career development coaching as well, which tends to always be in that IT space. Again, because I've worked in tech for such a long time, people come and speak to me about their kind of challenges or crossroads that they're at. So I typically help people develop their kind of leadership skills and what they need to do that. Or like find like their own career path and what they need to do for their own personal development. And it's the most rewarding job that anyone could ever have, really. And watching people have those light bulb moments, and then they're messaging you when they've got a promotion, or, you know, they've gone off and like kind of gone for that next kind of role, and they've gone up to like director level or C level. And you just, honestly, I've had moments where I'm like, do you know what? Good for you. Yes, yeah. Smashing it.
If you had a choice between coaching or service design transition, service delivery, which ones you choose?
Couldn't.
No?
No, because...
Dog?
You might have to edit that bit out because my dog's starved. I'm sorry about that.
I've got a dog as well. Don't worry. I've got down to talk to you about your dog. So you can tell me about your dog now. Tell me about your dog.
So Pippa, cockapoo, she's a light of my life.
Okay. I read on your LinkedIn bio that you're obsessed with your dog.
I am.
I'm also obsessed with mine. I've got Picasso. He's a Bichon Frise. He's not with me only because he barks, so he'd be barking non-stop in the podcast. So yes, I'm a big lover of dogs as well. But going back to that decision, you couldn't make a decision then across either of them. Do you enjoy doing both then, and maybe the variety of different work across both?
Yeah, I like the variety, but I also think they come really nicely together, because I totally think that there's going to be a shift and change within service management, and I've started to see that anyway. I think that the kind of coaching I do also includes training, and you know, there's some service management leadership training that goes into that, and I just really enjoy both, really. And I feel like that's such a really like cop out thing to say, isn't it? Like, I can't choose. I like them both. Yeah. But, you know, maybe actually, if I was to be really, really honest, now I'm thinking about it a bit more, maybe the kind of coaching, development, people stuff more so than maybe like going in there and doing like a service management assessment, which is fine, but it's not as people centric as like the coaching stuff, right?
Okay. I was expecting that answer the first time when I asked you. We got there at the end. So, 100%. I'm conscious of time because we have been chatting away for nearly an hour and it's supposed to be an hour's episode. And I haven't covered off everything that I want to. So we're going to try and wrap it up as quickly as possible. But sure. You still have some elements here which I think our listeners need to know about. So we touched on the book with David Barrow, and David's been on the podcast before, and great individual, and he I really enjoyed his insights into the kind of ITSM industry. He touched on allyship a little bit then as well, but it'd be great to understand, you know, what should we expect in the book.
So David and I have wrote this book in the form of a novel, and it's going to take the reader through a bit of a journey from both of our personal, like personal stories. We've also got contributors as well, kind of sharing things that have happened to them in the workplace. So it's both male and female. So it's coming from a male and a female perspective. And eventually it's coming together around kind of how allyship is so important, really. It's so important. And it's interesting how a lot of people go, you know, why people might find it a challenge, or why people might not be wanting to support, like men supporting women, for example. There's so many challenges around it, and we cover that in the book. And we also really wanted it to help other people to either kind of go on their own allyship journey, but also to learn from our own experiences as well.
That's good. I'm looking forward to the book release. When do you expect it to come out?
We're hoping for it to come out at the end of the summer, September time.
Okay, all right. So all you listeners out there, keep an eye out for Lucy and David's book and make sure you buy it straight away. I know you're a big advocate for women in technology, and you are co-founder of Women of ITSM. Talk to me a little bit about it.
So we had myself, Georgie and Sophie, we are the three co-founders of Women of ITSM. And we accidentally created a bit of a WhatsApp group full of these amazing women at work in IT service management. And then one day
you created one and you left all of us men out of it. Is that what you're trying to say?
Pretty much, yeah. Right, fine. I added someone in, and someone else added something in, and blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, we've got this like wonderful group of women. And then I said to Sophie and Georgie, I was like, do you know what? I feel like we've got something here. There's so many women that work in service management that can benefit from our experience and skills, and we're all very different women, but we've also got very different skill sets. And I said, why don't we create a community that's specifically for women that work in IT service management? Men are going to be invited too, by the way. Come along, allyship, you know, plug that too. And what we want to do with this community is like run community sessions, do some mentoring, do some training. You know, we're very fortunate with our network, you know, get access to like service management training, and come along with your question, like your burning questions, like, oh, I'm on this on-call rota, I keep getting called out at 3 a.m. Let's talk about it. Let's try and like come up with a strategy for you to take that back to your head of or director or whatever and fix that. So that's where the ideas come from, really. And I'm so excited. We're launching it in the summer, like officially launching it in the summer. So
you are definitely a busy lady at the moment with the book and your community and everything. Yeah, 100%. I haven't even touched on two podcasts you run. You're a co-host of Careers and Coffee, and you run your own podcast, Talk Female Friday. Give me a quick rundown on both of them.
Talk Female Friday, I don't do it anymore. Did it for 2 years during like the pandemic. It was all about talking about female related subjects, and I had an amazing load of guests on there. full stop. That's probably the quickest thing I can say about it. Careers in coffee, I do this with a colleague of mine. She's a senior leader, senior tech leader at Gymshark. And we came up with this idea kind of last year around, shall we try and share, because lots of redundancies isn't there at the moment, lots of redundancies, people, you know, been in businesses a long time, CVs, cover letters, we've got some experience with that. So I said, we kind of said together, shall we create a LinkedIn Live series and pop it on YouTube for anyone that wants to catch up with it? So we just do everything that's career related over a cup of coffee. The last season we did was with some amazing guests that talk about things like grit and resilience or kind of recruitment. Maybe you might want to come on our next one if you want to.
I'll give it
and,
a go.
Yeah.
I'll help you. Good. That's, okay. I like it a lot. Yeah, no, 100%. I've got one last question for you.
Yeah.
Before we finish, where do you see the future of ITSM?
The future of ITSM, I think, is definitely going to go down more of a human-centered design route. For a long time, service management has been, because it goes IT service management. So people have always been like, oh, it's tech, you know, you need to be able to be an app support developer. No, I think service management, and it is becoming like this too, it's going to be a lot more human-centered. It's going to be a lot more people-focused. It's going to be more business-centered as well. Because at the end of the day, service management is the foundation of keeping up your IT department. It's actually the foundation of keeping your business up. So really need to start looking at making sure those people are happy and delivering and able to do that.
Okay, I like it. Thank you very, very much. We're going to finish there with Lucy Grimwade. Thank you for having you on. I will look forward to having you on in the future. And you could tell me a little bit more about your, hopefully by then, your published book, and also a little bit more about Women of ITSM, the community you're setting up. But thank you very much for being on Tech Life Stories today.
Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. I'll speak to you soon. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast, Tech Life Stories, sponsored by tech talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. If you like what you hear, please leave a review on the podcast platform you are listening from. If you'd like to hear more from me, you can find me posting daily on LinkedIn, so look me up and connect. Remember, it's not what people think of you when you first start, it's what people think of you when you finish.